This is Icon Art Radio. It's Bill Teeple, that's me, and Alan Cobb, and Donna Colby. We're your hosts. We were sort of headed in one direction with this show. I was sort of pushing for how do you know what's good and what's bad, and we may get there. But that's sort of, but on our way there, how did we get onto the question of...
Well, we were talking about whether the town, a town the size of Fairfield, you know, has more than its share of large egos in comparison to a town the size of New York City. And I think we pretty much agreed that New York has proportionately larger egos at its disposal. So anyone troubled by the egos of Fairfield need only look to the egos of New York. But then that got into a more interesting topic that Donna brought up, which is the idea that a great artist like Picasso, realistically, you know, the vast majority of the population doesn't know who Picasso was and isn't directly influenced by him, and yet he has contributed a vast legacy of creativity and innovation to the world of art. And then I pointed out that he also had a monumental ego, which he was famous for. We were just touching onto the idea that that means that you can be great and have a big ego.
Because in looking at Picasso again as the example, he had a great ego, but at the same time when he was in his studio working, he was very childlike and authentic and would try anything, and even things that everybody around him was saying, you know, why are you doing that?
Yeah.
That's really ugly and that's stupid. And of course that it takes a strong ego to be willing
exactly.
to do that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's a very innocent kind of, almost
yeah.
like the ego of a little child who's saying, I won't do this and I will only do this.
No, I think ego is one of the things that drives the train here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. And a big ego doesn't have to be a defensive ego. I think sometimes we think a person has a big ego because they don't, and they're defending it all the time. If by big ego we mean, you know, a strong established ego, and clearly Picasso and Dali and a few other notables of the recent past had spectacularly solid, confident egos and weren't the least bit concerned about who they were. But that's part and parcel of the innocence that's required to be innovative.
Mm-hmm. And a big ego, like a strong ego in the sense of having a strong self-identity that isn't shaken by what other people think, that can be a very good thing. And a lot of people that who we think of as egotistical are just people who have a lot of bravado because they're very insecure.
Right.
Most people who are showy about their self-identity are people who really don't, they have a lot of doubts about it and they kind of need to be more vocal about who they are. So just about anything we can talk about has an on the other hand.
On the other hand, there are some things you can talk about that you really, there's nothing else you can talk about.
Well, I if you think of the sea of intelligences and the ripples on the wave of the one intelligence and the sea of intelligences, that something has to draw one wave up higher than the rest. And I would say that all the great artworks and the great achievements of society throughout history have been like a wave that everyone is the same potential human intelligence, but something has to rise up and create these special pinnacles of history and culture.
Yeah.
And I think it's that strong self-identity mm-hmm. that allows this individual thing to rise so high. So it seems like an important element.
Yeah. Well, if you happen to be swimming you know, if you dive down in the water and you swim up to the surface, and you happen to swim up to the surface at the same time that the water you're in is doing a big swell, then if the timing is right, you practically leap right out of the water when you hit the surface. And it's very exciting, and you really feel like you did it. And that's, you know, one of the great joys of the way the world works, is that even though timing and context and social forces and historical forces and things may be coincidentally all synchronizing behind something that you're doing, if you do it, if you're busy doing things at that time and you get that benefit of that push, you get to feel all the joy of doing it yourself, even though you could never have done it yourself in another time and place.
Yeah, and even in, let's say, 250 people graduate from the same art school in a certain summer, but a few of those people happen to be in that situation you were just describing, where they just happen to go to a spot where something is happening, the wave is cresting, and they are just like there. Their expression of art happens to fit with that way that wave is cresting, and certain people discover, and then they're on their bandwagon, and suddenly that person, out of those 250 people, that person is the one who becomes famous and recognized as an artist. Not necessarily the most talented person, generically, you know, of all of those 250 people, but somehow the fates have...
It's a confluence of forces that cause these things to happen.
Yeah.
And then you get a place where these things are happening. You get several people of this nature together, and you get a movement.
A movement, right.
That's an interesting example of the balance between being responsive and taking your own direction, because it's like swimming down a river. You know, if you're swimming and you're headed downstream, you get this wonderful feeling of power, because you go really fast and you have the ability to navigate, and you can see where you're going. And you're going much faster than you can swim, and it just feels totally empowering. Whereas if you try to swim in the other direction, you swim and swim and swim, and you don't seem to get very far. You may in fact be going backwards, which means you don't get to see where you're going. You only see where you've been, and you crash into things because you can't navigate. And you know, the third alternative is to cling to a rock, which takes energy even though you're not going anywhere, and you get battered by the water and eventually torn away to go downstream anyhow.
And people like Cézanne, for example, was a person who was swimming against the current, struggling very hard. And you really have to have a very, very strong vision and a very strong, I don't know whether you would call it ego or just compulsion, you know, that you just have to go in that direction no matter what the current is and no matter how much of a struggle you have to do to get there. But many of those people don't really feel very much a sense of fulfillment.
Right.
Like you said, you know, when you're swimming with the current, you have this kind of exhilaration, and people like Cézanne very rarely felt that sense of exhilaration, even though looking back at him through the eyes of history, we see what a great innovator and a great artist he was. So it's kind of a sad thing. It's a hard thing for a person to choose to do that, or to have a strong enough vision to be willing to struggle like that.
And I guess it makes you stronger, but it's sort of like that. It's just a matter of fate that you don't get to have that feeling of exhilaration. You don't get the joy of...
But he got something out of the work itself. There was some kind of yes that the work gave him, that even though everyone else around him was saying no, he felt like he was compelled to continue.
And that, right, that raises, yeah, a really important point in this metaphor, because I've been struggling with it ever since I just said it.
I was running.
Which is that there's more than one stream that we're in at any given time. It's the stream of, you know, the flow of evolution of the art world and of cult, social and cultural aesthetics that he was going against. But his own stream is the one he was going down.
That's
he was
a good
not
point.
Fighting
really
his own stream,
yeah,
or he wouldn't have gotten as far as he did.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I'm glad you pulled that all together.
Yeah, it
was. I was wondering all myself.
Yeah, because it's not unfulfilling to do that. It's again, Agnes Martin is a good example of someone who's going downstream. She's just, you know, taking one stroke and coasting for a half a day, probably. Mm-hmm. And she's painting with her back to the world, and there's no need for the art world to approve or disapprove of what she's doing. She couldn't care less. So she's not suffering from not going down that stream. She's not even in that stream. She's just stepped out of it.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I think is, this kind of refers back to what we were talking about in our last couple of shows about the changes that have been happening in the art world over the last 50 years or so. And one thing I'm feeling, not only in the art world, but in society in general, is more people being aware of the need to integrate opposites in life. And in the world of politics, you know, now there's so many more politicians now talking about getting rid of divisiveness and blending people who have opposite viewpoints. And I think that it's really the only direction that the art world can go now. To instead of going in the direction of defining what is art, what is good art, what's bad art, you know, what's successful art, instead it's more about the process of taking all of the different extremes of life and all of the different expressions of life and all of the different definitions of life and somehow finding a way for them to form chords create symphonies or something like that.
Well, I think John Stimson made an important point in one of the last shows where, you know, it really came out that our current culture has truly succeeded in separating art from the rest of culture. And that's something that may be unique to the modern world, that it be separated this much anyway. It's certainly been separated since the Renaissance, but we think of art as an end in itself and something that's done for the reasons that the artist has, and there isn't in a sense a cultural requirement for it or even a cultural context that it's supposed to be in. Only, you know, a tenth of a or a hundredth of a percent of artists are in the cultural mainstream and can be actually located using the culture. If you walk into a town, there's no way to find the artists in the town. Even in Fairfield, which likes to think of itself as an art town, there are dozens of artists that you never see their work and you never hear that they're artists and you don't know that they're artists and you don't know what they're doing. And the people who are in touch with art in Fairfield don't know much about them or what they're doing. So we have a notion of art in that is really very specialized. And maybe the art of the future isn't so specialized. You know, these paintings surrounding us right now, and by the way, for our listeners, we're recording in the Icon Gallery. I'm looking at the large works show and a few of the paintings that I can see from where we're recording. And these are, you know, what are they really? They're statements, they're presentations, they're announcements, they're proclamations, simply because they've been pushed into the community. And the artist is to some extent interested in pushing them into the community. The artist is not saying, oh no, I don't want them to be shown. The artist is saying, yeah, I'd love to have them be shown. And this is one I think that is particularly, you know, appropriate. And so what exactly are they doing? And in the cultural context, they're saying something, using a medium. How does that differ from, you know, a troubadour singing a song that tells the history of some town that's too far to get to, that you wouldn't know anything about otherwise? It's a kind of an arbitrary communication of something that some people think is worth saying and some people think is worth hearing.
I think we all have that impulse,
yeah,
to have an inner vision of some sort, whatever it is, and express it to other people. Just,
yeah,
radiate it out in some form to other people. And some people find that the language that they can translate those, their inner feelings and visions and everything into best is visual art. And some people feel like they can do it best in writing poetry. Some people can do it best being a political leader or whatever. But all of us, I think it's a really deep part of human nature of all time to express what we have inside and what we think and what we see.
It's interesting that the modern world is able to venerate that impulse. Because when I think of an agrarian society and people are working to survive all day long, there isn't as much room for that individual expression, although I'm sure in the evenings, you know, they get around to it. And they do sing their songs and do their dances and play their instruments,
yeah,
and make their decorations.
Which is just
and
as
things.
Much a,
sure.
Can be as fulfilling and worthy as...
Well, absolutely.
It's more integrated.
But yeah, that's what I mean.
You're making the baskets, but you're also making the most beautiful design.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
And it's much more integrated into the culture. The dancers are usually telling some kind of story that helps, you
yeah.
know, heal the society. And
yeah.
There
isn't a lot of time for it.
It's true that in the modern era, but we're really talking about going back into the Renaissance.
Yeah.
We have been able to set aside a realm of art, and this is what we were talking about with John, of the realm
yeah.
of the artist, I mean the
capital
period
A,
of the artist
yeah.
in society, where it's a separate world. And there, I guess that if there's enough idle time for certain people and enough wealth, mm-hmm. that it comes about.
Yes.
That if we're all struggling to survive and we have to all go out and root and hunt, then our art impulse cannot be denied. It will be there,
right.
but it'll be integrated with our hunting and rooting. But somehow, and this is, a lot of people raise the issue of this, you know, how can all this money and time and effort be going into this like idle behavior when we could be going out building another Habitat for Humanity home for someone, or
yeah.
giving that money to the poor? Or, you know, there's a realm of art that's cherished and
yeah.
and seems to be important, and that this disconnect, this place that these people go in and do this thing seems to have a lot of value to society in general, even though it's its own rarefied world.
Well, part of it has to do with people seeking heroic figures. We live in a very celebrity-oriented culture, and because of the media the way it is now, people can be a celebrity much more instantly than they ever could before. So, I mean, just as much as we all have something in our nature that wants us to give expression to our own inner vision, there's also something in human nature that makes us want to look to heroes of some sort. And our particular heroes that we have in culture today tend to be pop stars, movie stars, great artists to maybe a lesser degree because they're not as well known as the people you see in movies and all. But I think this goes back to our talk in the last show or the one before that about television, that it's like kind of an easy way for people to touch greatness to go to a museum and see great art, or to go to a concert and hear their rock star idol or something that they've had to wait for many hours or days in line to get tickets for. There's something that feeds people on some level to do that.
Well, I like to think that on some level it's the refinement of the, you know, productivity of those people. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe baseball players are paid too much money, but still the greatest baseball players are doing something that in the context of baseball skills is very exciting to people who care about baseball. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a singer who's somehow capturing how I feel about my life right this minute, mm-hmm. and does it just that much better than any of the other singers is going to be unforgettable to me, if you know. And then on top of that, of course, it's nice. I mean, we have this tendency to kind of crystallize everything and categorize things. So once we know that's good, then it becomes by definition good instead of by discovery. And we seek it out, you know, just because we know we'll get some of that. It's like if you liked a chocolate cake, then any chocolate cake will probably be good, even though when you actually eat them, you find that, you know, most of them aren't very good and only a few of them are memorable.
So I have a question for both of you. Do you think it's even possible in a culture where we're bombarded by so many influences constantly? Do you think it's even possible to have an innocent experience?
What do you mean by an innocent experience?
Well, we'll put it in the context of art, to see a painting and respond to it simply as an individual and not as somebody who has heard a lot of things about what you should like, shouldn't like, what everybody else likes.
Oh, I would say no, it's definitely not possible to have an innocent experience of a painting.
But that would be like the experience of a savant.
Yeah.
Someone right. who is able to be completely open and not influenced. But I think that the secret is, because I always like to refer to, we all talk about being present in the moment. Well, a dog is present in the moment.
Yeah.
Well, that's not something to aspire to. It's we've evolved beyond that. So what we want is to be present in the moment, but fully realized in all of the inputs that are available to us as a human intelligence. So you want to be standing in front of that painting, fully informed, actually want to know even more than we already know about how many ways we can see it, and still be absolutely open to it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the innocent state, is to actually, our goal, I think, is to be absolutely innocent and absolutely sophisticated and knowledgeable all at once.
Again, the opposites together.
Yeah, and this is what you brought up at the beginning of this show, and I completely agree. I think that if there's anything that's going to distinguish the art of the 21st century from art that has gone before, it'll be this quality of wholeness. And wholeness can only be given expression if it's all-inclusive, mm-hmm. and it doesn't deny anything. It's not holding the flag up for just one point of view, but includes all points of view in this particular form.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, you know, the idea of seeing something innocently is interesting, because you, in a sense, what's exciting about seeing a work of art that's challenging is that it reveals your non-innocence. You realize that you're not seeing it innocently, and then you get to look at what it is about the way you're seeing it that isn't seeing it for what it is, you know, what your prejudices are, what your cultural biases are. And it's not that we ever could not have them, as long as we're in the game, but at the same time, it helps us to know what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can see through them and know we're seeing through them. We still see through them, but at least we know we're seeing through them, and that's that's more.
It's probably simultaneous layers of experience too, because I think we do have innocent reactions to, like, we walk into a room in a museum, and immediately in the first second that we're in that room, there may be a certain painting that just like draws us based on colors or an image or something like that. And yeah. then if we go over and look at it, the other layers of our knowledge about that artist, of our, you know, all cultural biases and everything come into play as well. But probably in any experience, we do have those instants of just gut reaction, innocent response.
Yeah, I wonder how universal that is. I certainly, when I used to live in Switzerland, I was very intrigued by the fact that I like wristwatches, and of course there's no better place than to live in Switzerland, especially near Lucerne. And I would occasionally go into Lucerne for shopping or something, and Lucerne probably has more watch stores than any other city in Switzerland. And I'd be walking briskly down the street past maybe 50 watch stores in the course of my journey. And I would glance into the window and in a very short time take in all the watches on display in that window. And one out of 10 or 15 windows, there would be one watch that jumped out at me, that's what I considered to be closest to the archetype of watch, or the perfect watch. And that process just continued spontaneously. And all the years I was there, I couldn't walk past a watch store without glancing at the entire inventory in the window. And some of them have, you know, 300 or 400 watches in mm-hmm. in a window. And there'd be one or two, and I think that one is very nice except for that little quality, and I like that one except for that little thing, and this one is very close to perfect. And it's almost as though I am looking for the archetype, mm-hmm. and I'll know it when I see it. And it's a fascinating thing. It's like I know what I like without hardly even having to spend any time.
But is it your particular fulfillment in a watch?
Oh, I'm sure.
Because I know that other people would be doing the exact same thing and be pointing at a dozen other watches.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's very personal. It's my taste in watch. And judging by what's... or that was backwards. Anyway, but judging by what's available, you know, obviously it's not the most common taste.
But I think that is what drives each of us as artists.
Yeah.
Is that... tuning to that.
Right.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.